Good afternoon. Today is Tuesday, February 11th, and it's 1:30 p.m. This is Talk on the Rock, and I'm your host, Colette Zarnicki. Today, we're going to learn a little more on Wrangellite Sue Belita. She's the pastor at Island of Faith Lutheran Church here, and she was on the show last year in May. I surprised her with another Wrangellite, Mark Robinson.
Yes, you did.
And had them both play as opponents, sort of, trivia, where they named songs, and that was super fun. So they both volunteer here at the station and host theme song shows. You can catch Sue's show called Afternoon Matinee Thursdays at 1 p.m., but for today, she's going to share with us some stories of her global travel experiences. You can call in to ask a question. The number to KSDK is 874-2345. Hi, Sue. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm still very proud that I recognized Dead Man, the score from Dead Man.
That was a lot of fun.
That was.
So welcome back.
Thank
to
Talk you.
And Rock. So you're a global traveler, of course, and I've heard some of your experiences.
Yes.
And you've visited Rome a bunch of times.
Yeah, Rome is my place. I always say I hope people can find their place. And for some people, it's a cabin in the woods. For some people, it's the beach. For me, it just happens to be Rome. Rome is my place where I can unwind.
Okay, how long has it been your place, and how many times have you been there?
The first time I ever went to Rome was in April of 1998. My second time was in October of 1998. So Rome caught me right from the very beginning. And so it's just, I've been going almost once a year since then. Sometimes I squeeze in twice a year. Sometimes I skip a year. I'm skipping this year because it's the Jubilee year, and which is a huge festival, a Catholic celebration, and it just brings in enormous amount of people. So I will skip this year because it's just overly touristed this year.
Okay, so for the whole year it'll be?
Yes.
Like
it's
that?
The Jubilee year.
Wow.
Yep.
And what is it about Rome that makes it your place?
Do you know, it is one of those things. There are lots of Romes. You know, there's architectural Rome, there's historical Rome, there's artistic Rome, there's, just religious Rome. There are lots of ways that people experience Rome. And I initially started going because of the art. And so the museums are just world-class and extraordinary and always unique and interesting. But I really think what I discovered about Rome that I've never found anywhere else is Rome is a city that invites you to sit down. If you go into a cafe, you can sit there as long as you like. You can nurse a glass of wine for 2 or 3 hours and they'll never push you out. There are benches. There are places, little parks, along the streets, there are places to sit down. It invites you to sit down and stay a while. And I appreciate that. I love that, you know, the different piazzas, the different squares. You just sit down and maybe there's some musicians playing and maybe there's the bubble master entertaining the kids. And you can just sit. And I just find that freedom and that permission to just sit. And sometimes I sit and I look up and 2 or 3 hours have passed. And, you know, I'm not even conscious of that. I've just people watched or written in my journal or just sat and listened to music. And the time just goes and no one says, move along.
Yeah. I wonder if other people feel the same way. Have you had that discussion with anyone else?
I often talk to people about that because they're curious about that connection to Rome. And, you know, I've been to different places. I've been to Paris. I've been to London. I've been to New York. I've been to Seattle. And, you know, none of those places have that same sense of invitation of sit down and you're welcome to stay without being moved along. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I've experienced just feeling like I need to leave.
Right. Right. Yeah. And in Rome, that just doesn't happen. You can ask. First of all, they never present you with your bill at a restaurant or a cafe. You have to ask for it. And so if you sit there for 10 minutes after you finished your meal, they'll take away the meal and they won't say anything. So then you have to say, oh, yes, I would like to have my bill. And then maybe somewhere within the next half an hour, your bill will appear. And after you put down your money or your credit card, sometime within the next 15 or 20 minutes, they'll come and pick it up and bring it back to you. And then you don't even have to leave. You can still sit there. If you're in the middle of a conversation or writing in your journal or whatever it is, you're not asked to leave. You leave when everything is finished. And they do things on their time and you do things on your time. And time is very relaxed.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's cool.
That's really cool.
Unless you're, you know, one of those people who are frustrated and need to, you know, okay, we've already been to the Pantheon and we've been to St. Peter's Square and now we need to get to the Colosseum and I need my bill and I need it right now. Those people get very frustrated.
Right. Yeah. And you're not like that.
I am not.
How long? So, but you're usually in Rome for how much time?
Oftentimes around 10 days or so. Okay. Yeah. That's and you're right. I mean, one of the gifts of going many times is that I've seen the larger sites. I've seen many of the things. And so I don't need to go back unless I want to. And I have enough time. There are itineraries, you know, how to do Rome in a day, how to do Rome in 3 days. I can't even conceive of that because you don't, you know, you check off a checklist. But I don't even know that you really see anything when you do that. I'm sure it's a wonderful experience. And if it's the chance that you get and that's the time that you have, it's very exciting, I'm sure. Overwhelming, I'm sure. But I do have that longer experience of not necessarily having to do it all every trip.
Right. And just taking that time, absorbing.
Right.
Wherever you are.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay. You went in October.
Yes.
This past October. Will you share with us what was on your agenda and what you did?
I was fortunate to go for a whole month this time. It was part of an extended study break that the church had granted me. So I'd spent 1 month in Iowa in my seminary of September. And then all of October, I was in Rome. So on my itinerary was really some very intentional study time, which, you know, because I know that I can sit in a park and listen to buskers play music and read for, you know, 2 or 3 hours. That kind of thing was on my agenda. I really worked to not have a big agenda, but one of my things was I have been so many times, and, you know, there were a number of museums. And there still are a number of museums that I had actually never been to. And so that became part of my agenda was to explore those museums that sometimes get way down onto sort of the B itinerary list, plan B, that you don't ever quite really get to. And so I wanted to go to places that I had not yet been in all the times that I had gone to Rome.
Yeah. And will you just name and describe a couple of those?
So I went to the Museum of Musical Instruments, which you don't really associate a lot of musical instruments with Rome, right? I mean, Paris or someplace like that, you would think would have a much greater interest in a Museum of Musical Instruments. It was this wonky museum. Very much, you could see that it would be the kind of museum that children's field trips would go, school field trips would go to. And it was set up in room by room of development of all kinds of instruments. And it started out with instruments that had been archaeologically excavated. So whistles and timbrels and pipes and flutes and things like that. Absolutely fascinating. Of course, all very artistically carved, right, in terms of animal heads that made little pipes and whistles and things. So there was that. And then the development, there was the harpsichord that becomes pianos, that becomes organs. There was, you know, the development of the clarinet and the oboe and the saxophone and flutes, and then the development of string instruments. So there were rooms dedicated to each of these particular instruments and their iterations across time. It was great. It was just really interesting. It was a great afternoon. And who would, it's pretty off the beaten path. So you have to go find it, first of all. But it was great.
Yeah. And we just say, like, what was the oldest, the most ancient instrument there that you can remember?
The pipes were really old. Maybe the oldest, though, are things called sistrums. They are they're tambourine-esque. So they're this little handle that comes up into almost a wishbone shape with a wire that goes across and little circular jangles on it, like tambourine jangles. Yeah. And you shake that back and forth.
Oh, wow.
So sistrums were old and the pipes were old.
Do you know how old those were?
Yeah. Really old, like archaeological dig old.
Amazing.
But they also had, because a lot of instruments can't be preserved across time. And so, but they also had like frescoes or pieces of jugs that had people playing instruments on them, like the double pipes that you see sometimes in biblical music that, you know, people are movies that they're playing. And so there was a lot of depictions of instruments as well as some ancient instruments themselves.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was very neat. And again, just this wonky little way out the road kind of museum.
Yeah. And you also told me that you went to a museum that was all about writing. What was that like?
So I was on my way to a museum that I've only been to one time that has enormous mosaics and frescoes and things. But it was, again, in a part of town that I don't really hang out in very much. So I was kind of like, oh, I think it's this way. And on my way to that museum, I found this other museum that I'd never been to. And it was, there's one Sunday a month that most of the city museums are free. And it was that Sunday. So I'm like, well, here's this museum I've never been to before, and it's free. I wonder what it's about. So I had no idea what the museum was when I went in. And so this first room had this enormous display of, it was all about writing. Who wrote, what they wrote, and what they wrote with. And it was this whole variety, this spectrum of a general writing army orders, a cook writing a recipe, a mother writing a son, a person writing a funeral stele, an inventory. There was a toast that was etched on a glass for like a wedding. You know, all of these things. So who did the writing? Well, military people. It was really fascinating, the spectrum of literacy, right? Because who could write? And it was a woman shop owner and a general and a mother and scribes and stewards, land stewards, and people turn to for magical things. So blessings and curses and spells. And then what they wrote on and what the instruments they used. So they wrote on copper. They wrote on papyrus. They wrote on skins. They used inks that they had to manufacture. They used chisels. Just all this variety of writing. And then the rest of the museum were displays of writing, you know, of these great genealogies and wars and a line of Caesars and a funeral stele and donation plaques and just amazing. It was this whole celebration of writing that I had not even noted in guidebooks. And I mean, I read through guidebooks before I go, right? That one never came in. And so I went back and went through my guidebooks, and you could find like a sentence or two, but it was just totally overlooked in all of my travels, really mostly overlooked in the guidebooks. And it was mind-blowing. It was a wonderful museum.
Oh my goodness. So, okay, so you saw the handwriting of, from people.
Yes.
Was it on different languages or one?
Yeah, no. There was some in Greek. There was some in Hebrew. There was some in Italian. There was some in Latin. It was yes, across this whole spectrum of languages.
Yeah, and do you know, like, how they acquired all this historical, you know, writing and all that?
And a lot of it came from archaeological work of digs, of donations of, you know, people have collections and when they die, they will contribute a collection. Some things were retained in like Caesar's palaces. Mm-hmm. So like genealogies of a Caesar would be scavenged a little bit from those walls to be brought into the central museum.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you remember the name of the museum?
It's the museum that celebrates writing.
Oh my goodness. Yes. So also this past October in your travels, mm-hmm. you harvested olives in Tuscany. How did you end up on an olive farm in Tuscany?
And it is quite the tale. And it is also part of the gift of time. Because if you're only there for a few days, right, to take time out of your time in Rome to go on a olive harvest in Tuscany, I mean, I had to take 4 or 5 days to go do this. I have been, for the last 15 or so years, been going to the same guest house in Rome. And I've gotten to know the owner of the guest house very well. We chat for long periods of time every time I go. And I've known for a long time that his desire, he is a Roman-born man. Mm. And one of his desires has always been to own a farm in Tuscany. Mm. And so he's been going for years, you know, looking at real estate, trying to figure out how he could make it work. And circumstances all came together last year, well, actually in 2023, for him to be able to buy a grove of 600 olive trees with a house in the hills of Tuscany. Wow. So he bought that like in November of 2023. And so his first harvest was in October of 2024, because you have to wait, you know, for a season.
Yeah.
When he bought it, he was too late into the season to do the harvest.
And you were there for the first harvest.
Well, so he tells me all of this, that he finally bought this, and he's showing me pictures of this. And he says, so we're having our first harvest, and it's this week. And then he gave me kind of this funny look, and he said, would you like to come? I was like, I would love to come. I think that would be so exciting. And then I think he had this thought of, oh my gosh, this is a guest in my guest house. She comes to Rome. Is she really going to, you know, does she know what she's getting into? You could see all of that kind of flash behind his eyes. Because the next day he said, do you really want to come? And I said, you know what? I really do want to come. And so the next day, he picked me up in his car. We drove up to Tuscany to his home, which the home had and the grove had belonged to a man who was in failing health and who had died. And so for many years, he had not been well. So he had not kept up the groves and the house was still pretty rustic. So and Fabio hadn't had a lot of opportunity yet to upgrade much of anything. You know, he was trying to figure out how to do a harvest. Mm. And this year he was really only able to harvest maybe 60 trees out of the 600.
Okay.
So everything is a learning process, a growing process. And the house kind of takes second place to the harvest. So there's no hot water. My bedroom door never quite closes all the way. There were very significant instructions on how to flush the toilet. So it was very wonky, you know. It was just, everything was just very close to the earth.
Yeah.
And so, okay, we're going to get up the next morning. And Fabio and I were the only two there for the first day. And then other people started, you know, kind of filtering in to help. So the first day, though, Fabian, there are different kinds of olive trees. There are table olives and then there are olive oil olives. And the table olive trees, there were few enough of those that Fabio and I could pick those ourselves. So, and they were a little bit of a learning curve for us, because you just don't go and start with your fingers picking. That's farthest from the truth. So before you can pick a tree, first the tree has to be prepared. So you have to clear out everything from underneath it, because you're going to spread these big long nets around it. You have to break off growth that's been growing up around the trunks. You have to clear out any parasitic vines that have been growing or plants that have been growing. So preparing a tree takes a while.
Wow.
And if you think about, you know, there's 600 of these trees. I mean, it took significant time for us to do the trees that we did. So then we're ready. We've spread these giant nets out underneath the tree. And Fabio had this mechanical rake that, you know, it shakes the top. So he would start at the top of the tree and kind of shake what would fall down. And then I had a longer manual bamboo pole with a little plastic rake on the end that I would pull down the second thing. And anything that we could get with hands later, we got. But then you have to joggle everything off of these nets into a collection spot and put these nets, the olives from the nets, into these baskets. And then those olives, the table olives, you soak for a year. Mm. They're you can't eat them now. They're bitter. They're, you know. So we did the first processes of getting them immersed and taking all the, you know, branches and leaves and everything out, all that skimming and stuff. So we harvested those trees. Then we started with the big trees. And the other really technical thing, I mean, like I say, everything was a huge process that I never would have known. But olive trees require very particular soil, and that soil is best on hillsides. Huh. So you're doing all of this on angles.
Oh, wow.
You have to walk on these angles and manipulate all of these things on top of, while you're standing on these slick nets to catch the olives. So you're on these hills with nets that there's no footing, there's no holding to it. So it was astonishing, and it was the most exhausting physical work that I have ever done. Mm. It made me so appreciate a jar of olive oil. The work that goes into, you know, every process of it. Because then, I mean, we have these baskets that you have to load up on the truck, and the truck then takes, on a particular day, you have to have your slot reserved to go to the mill on a particular day to have them pressed to get your olive oil then. I mean, it was a huge process.
Wow. Okay. So you did that for 4-5 days?
I did it for 5 days.
5 days.
Yes.
How long each day?
From early morning until late at night. And it was the really lovely thing. So Fabio's father-in-law came, because he has a few olive trees. So he was kind of our expert in the field, for as much as any of us were experts, because we all were just, you know, trying to figure this out. And at the end of my time, his pronouncement was, "Suellen is very fit." I'm like, "Suellen has been living on Tylenol." And so there was this great joke, because I was leaving then on Saturday. I was meant to leave to take a train back to Rome on Saturday. Mm-hmm. So Fabio was going to drive me into the station and put me on a train, and I would go back to Rome, and they would all stay and continue the picking. Mm-hmm. So I said on Friday night, I said, "Fabio, what time is my train tomorrow?" He said, "Oh, Suellen, I meant to tell you, there is a strike. You have to stay the weekend." I'm like, "Oh, no," because they announced the strikes ahead of time.
Wow.
And I'm like, "Oh, okay." I was out of the Tylenol that I'd brought. So I'm like, "All right." Well, Saturday morning, he said, "Oh, they've announced the strike is at 6 and your train is at 4, so you're okay." So I was able to leave on the day that I had planned.
Oh, my goodness.
I was so grateful. It was such hard work. It really was. Yeah. But it was amazing. Yeah.
That is amazing. And can you just say, because I've never been to Italy, I've never been across the big oceans, and for other people too, can you just give an idea of how far of traveling is it from Rome to Tuscany?
About 2.5 hours by car.
Okay.
Where his farm was, where his grove is.
Okay.
Yeah, about 2.5 hours.
And is there, I mean, obviously there's probably a difference in environment there, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Rome is built on 7 hills. And so there's this gentle, and they are hills. They're not mountain-esque, right? And it's urban. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate all the green spaces that are in Rome. It's very dedicated to its green spaces. But once you get out past the suburbs, I mean, the roads go along the ocean because it's that western side of Italy.
Yeah.
So you've got the ocean, and then the mountains get higher and higher and higher. It's really interesting because the towns in Tuscany are built on top of the hills, on top of the mountains. And part of that was because that was a military strategy, because they're all fortified by walls and towers and all of that because of the wars. But also, Fabio told me, it was because it got them up out of the mosquito, the swampy land. And so it was healthier to be on top. If you built down in the lowlands, you got diseases, swampy diseases. So,
yeah. Wow. And I also want to add, Sue brought a bottle of the olive oil here. Will you just share, tell us about this bottle of olive oil.
So this bottle of olive oil is from the very first pressing of Fabio's first harvest from olives that I contributed in the picking.
Yeah.
And so he brought this bottle in for me. And it's like a genie in the bottle. I mean, it's this beautiful little bottle. And he said, I think this will travel because I carry on. You know, he said, I think this is a small enough amount, but a significant enough amount that you'll be able to bring it home. And I just did not want it to be confiscated in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought 3 mini bottles of limoncello, which is a aperitif. And I drank those each night across 3 nights, washed out the mini bottles of limoncello, and then poured my olive oil in them because I knew they would pass for not enough liquid. Poured out my shampoo and all that kind of stuff to make enough room in my quart bag of liquids, and brought home the bottle, and then I put them back in. But it was great because you could even see the very first picture I took of this, because I was just awestruck. It was cloudy, because the sediment hadn't settled yet. And so now across time, it's just so clear and so beautiful because the sediment has all settled. So it's a work of art.
Yeah.
But I also remember how hard that work was to have even just this little bit of olive oil.
Yeah, and do you think you will have the opportunity to taste the olives when they're ready?
The table olives?
The table olives.
Do you know? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not going this year. So right. If they have to sit for a year, maybe if I go, when I go in 2026.
Maybe he could save to
have some of those table olives. Yeah.
Or send you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you're in Italy and you're in Rome,
mm-hmm.
what language do you speak?
I speak tourist Italian and English.
Nice.
Yeah, because almost everybody in Rome, especially, knows some tourist English at a minimum. And so quite often I will ask things or converse in my Italian, and they'll speak back to me in their English. And so that's how conversations, because I like to try to use my Italian.
Yeah.
But it is very touristy Italian.
Yeah.
I don't conjugate well.
Yeah. Yeah. I have the same experience with Spanish.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what do you have any suggestions for people specifically? I mean, anybody really, but I'm also thinking solo travelers, because you have traveled so many times alone, right?
I do. Right.
Do you have any suggestions for people who want to travel if they've have little experience or no experience with traveling?
The main thing, especially if you're traveling by yourself, is just not to be afraid, just to do it. You know, you use common sense, you pay attention, but I have never felt afraid. I have never felt threatened. I've never felt any kind of impingement. And I have walked in Rome at 11 o'clock at night after I've been to a concert or after I've been to a show. I walk, and there is a lot of safety.
Yeah.
And so part of it is just don't be afraid. Just go ahead and do it. And people don't look at you weird. You know, restaurants are amazing at configurations. Like if you walk in with a party of seven, they'll make a table out of nowhere. And if you walk in as a party of one, there will be a table for you. And they don't, you know, like put you by the bathrooms or the kitchen, like a lot of American restaurants do.
Yeah, that's right.
No, it's just, you know, it's probably safer than you think. And it's a lot more fun than you think. And it is time to do what you want for as long as you want. If you go into a museum and you want to spend 6 hours, you can spend 6 hours. If you go into a museum and you're like, oh, this isn't my cup of tea, then you can leave in 20 minutes.
Right. Yeah.
So
right.
Just do it. Just go.
Do it. Yep. That's right. Is there anything else you would like to share about the world, about your travels?
There is so much. And I guess that really fascinating thing is don't be afraid to do the stuff that's not the big ticket stuff. You know, I went into another museum, the Napoleonic Museum, and I found this great painting of the 9 ages of Napoleon. And it was each one was a hat. Mm. And I haven't stopped thinking about that. What a cool depiction of the eras of Napoleon through his hat. So, you know, find those offbeat things where you have most of the museum to yourself. You know, yes, you can be among thousands of people at the Vatican Museum, or you can be the only person listening to a harpsichord in the Museum of Musical Instruments.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing some of your travel experiences. I know there's so much more. So that was Sue Belita. Yes, thank you. It was such a pleasure. And we are now going to hop on into World Cafe.